at Romans chapter 13, verse 1 through verse 7, and then after that a passage in Matthew. Romans chapter 13, verse 1 through verse 7. Let every person be subject to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except from God, and those that exist have been instituted by God. Therefore, whoever resists the authorities resists what God has appointed, and those who resist will incur judgment. For rulers are not a terror to good conduct, but to bad. Would you have no fear of the one who is in authority? Then do what is good, and you will receive his approval. For he is God's servant for your good. But if you do wrong, be afraid. For he does not bear the sword in vain. For he is the servant of God, an avenger who carries out God's wrath on the wrongdoer. Therefore one must be in subjection, not only to avoid God's wrath, but also for the sake of conscience. For because of this you also pay taxes. For the authorities are ministers of God, attending to this very thing. Pay to all what is owed to them. Taxes to whom taxes are owed, revenue to whom revenue is owed, respect to whom respect is owed, honor to whom honor is owed. And then the next passage is from Matthew chapter 22, verse 34 to verse 40. Matthew chapter 22, verse 34 to verse 40. But when the Pharisees heard that Jesus had silenced the Sadducees, they gathered together. And one of them, a lawyer, asked him a question to test him. Teacher, what is the greatest commandment in the law? And he said to him, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind. This is the great and first commandment. And a second is like it. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. On these two commandments depend all the law and the prophets. And with that, we're going to invite our brother.
In a remarkable life occurred on Sunday, October the 28th, 1787, when William Wilberforce penned these words in his diary. He wrote, God Almighty has set before me two great objects, the suppression of the slave trade and the reformation of manners. And God really had set before him two great goals, and these goals were going to be the impetus for a life of intense activity. But it is vital to understand that the man who articulated these goals and articulated what would really be his life's work wrote as a man who was fully and fervently committed to the Lord Jesus Christ. If this was the defining moment of his life, then his conversion to Christ was the great turning point. His was a faith that really worked. After his death, the York Herald of August 3rd, 1833 said this, his warfare is accomplished, his cause is finished, he kept the faith. Those who regard him merely as a philanthropist in a worldly sense of that abused term know but little of his character. To quote the title of one of the biographies of Wilberforce, he was in a very real sense, in a profound sense, God's politician. Try and understand him a little bit. We're going to look at his context, then his conversion, his calling, his career, and then his character, and then I ran out of C's, and we'll look at some implications. But I'll start with this. You'll see drawings of him on the right, and then you'll see the gentleman who portrayed him in the movie Amazing Grace, which maybe some of you have seen. It's funny how they always choose someone who looks really good-looking. So let's talk about the context, his early life. Wilberforce was born on August 24th, 1759. He was the only son of Robert and Elizabeth. Of his three sisters, only Sarah would reach maturity. Wilberforce's father would die when he was only 9 years old, and as a result of an inheritance that he would receive from his father, as well as a bestowment from his uncle William, he was independently wealthy throughout his life. But despite being rich in this present age, he wasn't haughty. He wasn't a man who trusted in riches, but rather he would really epitomize the apostolic injunction to do good, to be rich in good works, ready to give, willing to share. And in fact, in later years, he would regularly give a quarter of his annual income to the poor. You can see here that he was born and raised in fairly excellent circumstances. These are pictures of his home. You can see a statue there that graces the front courtyard, and this up here is where he did his schooling. So he had a fairly affluent beginning, and that characterized his whole life. After a year after his father's death, he was sent to live with his aunt and uncle, William and Hannah. And while he was in their home, he was exposed to the preaching, can you imagine, of George Whitefield and John Newton. And he especially loved and was enthralled by the preaching of John Newton. His mother, however, was very anti-Christian, thoroughly opposed to evangelical religion, which Wilberforce would later say she considered to be just a little less than poison. And so she spirited him away from London, brought him back to where they lived, and sought to throttle any kind of evangelical influence from his life. William's sons would later say that a rare and pleasing character of piety characterized him during that 12th year of his life when he was with his aunt and uncle, but his mother and his friends throttled that influence and spared no pains to stifle them. And as a result, he grew into young manhood and gave himself, he says, to the theater, to balls, to great suppers, and to card parties. When he was 17, he entered Cambridge, and his academic career was less than sterling. And he would write later that the Wilberforce, or rather I'm saying that the Wilberforce of Cambridge was a frivolous and fun-loving young man. And he would later say, "I used to play cards and nothing else." He was gregarious. And he says that a biographer says that his talents, his wit, his kindness, his social powers, and his love of society made him the center of attraction to all the clever and the idle of his college. Let me give you a little bit of an idea as to his social calendar, the kind of social calendar that make a strong man weak. This is from 1874. He writes this in his diary. February 24th. Dined at Lord Camden's, went to the Prince of Wales levee, to the opera, supped at Goose Tree, that's a social club, and to bed at 3 a.m. February 24th, very tired. Dined at Mr. Smith's, then Lady Howe's ball, danced till 4:30, then bed. August the 5th, dined at William Pitt's, jolly large party. At night, returned to Wimbledon, bed, 4:30 a.m. So that's the kind of social calendar he kept up, and no wonder he says that he did no good in those days. At Cambridge, he met a man named William Pitt, who would be the future Prime Minister of England, and Pitt described Wilberforce as a man who possessed the greatest natural eloquence of all the men I have ever met. That was no mean compliment coming from Pitt, who himself had extraordinary oratorical skills. Both men were well equipped for the kind of back and forth of parliamentary debate. And so it was that Pitt was elected to the borough, to Parliament representing the borough of Appleby, and Wilberforce, at the tender age of 21, was elected to Parliament representing his hometown of Hull. So these two men really destined for politics and in the providence of God, that's where they served. William later would become the representative of Yorkshire, a much more powerful region, and he would serve his nation for 45 years in Parliament. However, the early years were by no means exemplary. He says, "The first years that I was in Parliament, I did nothing. Nothing that was to any purpose. My own distinction was my darling object." How many is that true? So this is Pitt. That's a drawing of him there. That's a drawing of him there. That's him in Parliament. And over here is Sherlock Holmes portraying William Pitt. I should show you one other picture, I think. And so, yeah, so this is, again, this is Pitt over here. This is Pitt over here. He would become the youngest prime minister in the history of England to that point at the age of, some say, 23, some say 24. And here are the two movie stars portraying our heroes. Now, conversion. Wilberforce says that his own distinction was his great concern in those days. But in 1784-85, Wilberforce was at the pinnacle of achievement. At only the age of 24, he had won an unassailable position both in politics and in society. Office could not long be delayed for him, and his future was just wonderfully bright. And it's at this point that God lays hold of him. He would admit that at the time he was by no means a Christian. And he would insist in those days that evangelical views, such as we hold, were held only by vulgar and at least uninformed, enthusiastic persons. Enthusiastic was not a compliment. However, two vacation trips to the continent. Remember, he is wealthy beyond our imagination, and so he can take these long, lengthy trips to the continent. He would take two trips to the continent in the company of a man named Isaac Milner, who was an evangelical Christian. And that would prove to be the decisive turning point in his life. In the course of their holidays, the two would read and discuss Philip Doddridge's The Rise and Progress of Religion in the Soul. And so they'd ride along in a carriage, read excerpts of this book, and then discuss. They would also study the Greek New Testament. Profound conviction of his, this is a quote, "great sinfulness in having so long neglected the unspeakable mercies of my God and Savior," would follow, and until finally in Easter of 1786, the gloom would lift. And you could see the change in his diary. If you read his diary, you read words like this: darkness, coldness, weakness, wretched. And then after the turning point, you begin to read words like peace and hope and grace. The absence of his old prejudices would be evident in the radical change that God had brought about. And he says this. He says that now I expect to hear myself universally described as a Methodist. May God grant that it may be said in truth. It was at this point that John Newton would become of immense help to Wilberforce. The fashionable world, of which Wilberforce was a very vibrant part, would look upon evangelicals like Newton with contempt and with suspicion. And consequently, Wilberforce said that he had 10,000 doubts about whether he should go and talk to John Newton and gain some guidance from him. Well, eventually he plucks up the courage and he goes and he talks to Newton, and he says that the visit was of enormous benefit. He says, "When I came away, I found my mind in a calm and tranquil state." He said he found Newton to be, there's something very pleasing and affecting about John Newton, still humorous and quaint, and yet with the marks of sainthood. And the area where Newton gave him guidance at this particular meeting was in the area of whether he should be involved in politics. William had become increasingly convinced that if he was really going to serve God, he had to withdraw from politics. John Newton disagreed. And words that he would write to Wilberforce 2 years after that meeting really sum up and encapsulate the advice that he gave him at that meeting. 2 years later, he would write this: "It is hoped and believed that the Lord has raised you up for the good of his church and for the good of the nation." And that's really the advice that he gave him at that first occasion. William Pitt, who was not a believer, gave him the same advice. And so the old African black blasphemer and the future Prime Minister of England, who was not a believer, gave him good counsel and were instrumental in thrusting Wilberforce back into the area of politics where his life's work would be performed. Now, his calling. There's an oak tree that, well, the remains of it still stand in what's called the Holwood Estate in Kent, in England. That was Pitt's home, William Pitt's home. And by the way, if you're interested, that home, the Holwood Estate, in 2015 went on the market, and you could buy it for £12 million. There's an oak there, the remains of an oak tree. And I'll show you a picture in a moment. And it was there that you will find a plaque that says the Wilberforce Oak. Because at that spot, that's where William Pitt and William Grenville, both of whom were prime ministers of England, would meet with Wilberforce. And they would encourage him. They would give him a providential push in the direction of his great work. And Pitt said, "Wilberforce, why don't you give notice of a motion on the subject of the slave trade?" There were several other factors that pushed him. There was a man named Sir Charles Middleton, who was one of only two publicly known evangelicals in the House of Commons at the time that William Wilberforce began his career. When Wilberforce died, there were about 100. He brought pressure on Wilberforce to do something about the slave trade. There was a man named Thomas Clark who wrote a book, Slavery and Commerce in the Human Species. And he would frequently visit Wilberforce and talk to him and urge him to do something about the slave trade. And then there was the continued influence and advice and counsel of John Newton. And in these ways, God brought Wilberforce to the point where he would write what I said earlier in his diary: "God Almighty has set before me two great objects, the suppression of the slave trade and the reformation of manners." Now, there's from the movie, there's John Newton and Wilberforce. This over here is the Holwood Estate. You can see, if you can see from where you are, that's a nice place. That's where John Newton was pastor in London. Now there's the oak that I was telling you about. There are the remains of the oak, and here are Pitt and Newton, who influenced him in that direction. Now, this is interesting. This is a drawing of, over here, this is a drawing of Pitt and Wilberforce sitting by the oak and discussing this whole matter, with Pitt urging him in the direction of doing something about the slave trade. This is a picture, this is a photograph. And it's a photograph of a number of men, in particular this man, Samuel Crowther. This is a picture taken 40 years after Wilberforce died. It's a picture taken as they sit by the oak where Wilberforce had sat. And this man, Crowther, was the first black Anglican bishop. And so you can understand the significance of the photograph, and you can understand why he would have wanted to have a photograph taken on that particular spot. His calling. Now, let's talk about his career. It's clear from his mission statement that the cause of the slaves was not his only concern. He's known for the former, or for the cause of the slaves, but there was more to his agenda than that. By the reformation of manners, Wilberforce meant morals. And he would seek to change the face of the nation and address the wastefulness of the upper classes and the suffering of the lower classes. Now, you have to understand that Wilberforce's gospel was not a social gospel. We see so much of it in our day. It's not something he subscribed to. He understood the need for a saving relationship to the Lord Jesus Christ, and that's the root of any true reformation of life. But nonetheless, he and his associates exerted an increasingly strong moral pressure on the political arena of the day. And his desire was to clean up society's blights. Now, England in those days was flourishing in many ways. And probably in the 18th century was a country no more given to vice than any others. But it was nonetheless true that no other age had ever paraded its weaknesses so openly and excessively. Now, I want to give you a lengthy quote. John Stott, in one of his books, quotes a man named J. Wesley Brady and his scathing indictment of life in England in the 18th century. Brady writes about the deep savagery of much of the 18th century, which was characterized by the wanton torture of animals for sport, the bestial drunkenness of the populace. We should note that even William Pitt would not hesitate to show up drunk to the House of Commons. The bestial drunkenness of the populace, the inhuman traffic in African Negroes, the kidnapping of fellow countrymen for exportation and sale as slaves, the mortality of parish children, the universal gambling obsession, the savagery of the prison system and the penal code. It was said that no country in the world had as many capital crimes as England. So you do this and you die. No country in the world had as many occasions where that was going to happen. The welter of immorality, the prostitution of the theater, political bribery and corruption. Such manifestations suggest that the British people were then perhaps as deeply degraded and debauched as any people in Christendom. Brady then goes on to say this. Then things began to change. Why did things begin to change? Well, he says, then things began to change. In the 19th century, slavery and the slave trade were abolished. The prison system was humanized. Conditions in factories and mines were improved. Education became available to the poor, etc. Whence this pronounced humanity? The passion for social justice and sensitivity and the human wrongs. From whence did this come? There is but one answer, and he points to the evangelical revival under the Wesleys and Whitfield. The evangelical revival did more to transfigure the moral character of the general populace than any other movement British history can record. And so, really, England is spared the kind of revolution that came upon France. And God did wonderful things through the Wesleys and through Whitfield. William Wilberforce played no small part in the working out of that evangelical religion. And while he recognized that regulating outward conduct did not change the heart, he used political means, those means that were at his disposal, to make goodness fashionable again. Not greatness, but goodness. He was always an evangelist, but he was also a politician whose passion it was to alleviate suffering and expunge immorality wherever it was found. And so you and I need to recognize that whenever enemies of the faith argue that Christianity has always had a malevolent effect upon society, it's because they haven't read history. And we should not be intimidated by that kind of accusation. In order to make goodness fashionable again, the first thing he did was to encourage the king, George III, to reissue the proclamation. This is what it's called, the Proclamation for the Encouragement of Piety and Virtue and for the Preventing of Vice, Profaneness, and Immorality. And to give teeth to that, Wilberforce set up all kinds of societies to promote virtue at a local level. He addressed issues such as justice and drunkenness and lewdness. He enlisted the aid of the movers and shakers of his day, not all of whom were religious. And he would do this in order to promote goodness and righteousness and virtue, alleviate suffering, and ultimately bring glory to God. Now let me show you what Wilberforce was involved in. This is all part of his effort to bring about the reformation of manners. So if you can read that, I'll read through it. These are the kinds of things that he was involved in. Now, this is all besides the slave trade, which is his life's work. These are the kinds of things that he was involved in. He was involved in prison reform along with Jeremy Bentham and Elizabeth Fry, names I'm sure you're familiar with. He was governor of St. Bartholomew's Hospital, involved in the training of men for the ministry in the Anglican Church. He was involved in the education for the poor and for the Sunday school movement, involved in the education of the deaf. He was generous to a fault. And before his marriage, he regularly gave away a quarter of his income. He also provided an annuity to Charles Wesley's widow from 1792 till 1822, and this is all from his own resources. He was the founder of the Royal Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals. He fought the cause of the chimney sweeps. He fought the cause of single mothers. He sought the welfare of soldiers and sailors. He established orphanages for criminal poor children, children of those who had been put in prison. He helped form the British and Foreign Bible Society. He helped launch the Church Missionary Society, 1798. He helped send missionaries to Tahiti, and he was a regular supporter of William Carey's mission in India and did a variety of things to help promote missions there as well as around the world. He was involved in the Society for the Education of Africans. He was involved in the founding of the Society for the Relief of Debtors. And over a five-year period, he obtained the release of 14,000 people from debtors' prison. He was president, vice president, or committee man of no less than 69 societies. He was the man who led by example. Okay. Led by example. And his involvement in philanthropic endeavors was just monumental. It is said that factories didn't spring up more rapidly in Leeds and Manchester than schemes of benevolence under Wilberforce's roof. So that's the reformation of manners. I mean, that would be enough. If you gave your life to that for the cause of Christ, well, God bless you. But that isn't really the focus of his life, and it's not the first thing we think about when we think of Wilberforce. The fight for slavery, the fight against slavery. 200 years ago, Britain was the world's largest slave trading nation. This, Wilberforce called it the execrable villainy. This involved purchasing human beings in Africa for beads and the like, transporting them to the West Indies or the Americas, and that was a trip marked by unspeakable suffering. And during that trip, the Middle Passage, approximately 10% of the cargo perished. And upon arriving at the destination, strong men would be sold for 40 pounds, while the sick and the injured would be lumped together with women and children, and they would be sold off at a discount. So this is what happens. So English ships would sail. They'd sail down to Africa, and then they would buy people from other people, and then they would carry them across what's called the Middle Passage and sell them over here in the West Indies and then take their profits back to England. And during that middle passage, horrendous things would be done. There was opposition to the abolition of the slave trade. It's hard for us to imagine, but there was opposition. Why were people opposed to abolishing the slave trade? For at least two reasons. There are others, but these two at least. First, the trade was profitable. It made them a lot of money. The profit was often over 100% of the initial outlay. The trade constituted about 5% of British exports. Provided jobs. 18,000 people in England were involved in making goods so that they could buy people, so that they could sell people. Provided jobs. There were 5,500 sailors who manned 160 ships involved in the slave trade. So look, this was profitable. The second argument is national security. The trade involved and allowed for training ground for British seamen and excellent experience for these men. And furthermore, the argument was that if the British ceased to carry slaves, then competing nations in Europe would simply wax rich and wax powerful. And so extraordinary wickedness is justified on the basis of profit and self-interest. How often is that not the case in the history of this dark world? Now, many had raised their voices in the past against the slave trade, but efforts at abolition had to be galvanized under the leadership of William Wilberforce. The battleground was going to be the British Parliament. The movement now, with Wilberforce throwing in his lot, the movement now had its champion. And he would lead the charge by doggedly introducing bills in the British Parliament year after year after year. The first bill he introduced came in May of 1789. The last came in 1807. So 18 years, year after year after year, again and again and again. And then finally, the slave trade is abolished in 1807. Slavery itself would end in the empire in July of 1833. Wilberforce and his companions were on the front lines, but they understood that they needed the goodwill of the English people to give teeth to their efforts. He writes, "It is on the general impression and feeling of the nation that we must rely. So let the flame be fanned." They understood that they needed to convince the people. There needed to be a groundswell of opposition if there was going to be real change and if they were going to be able to bring that change about in the British Parliament. So how did they do that? Well, they did it in a variety of ways. The print of Thomas Clark's model of a slave ship, I'll show you that in a moment, and its tragic cargo, that was circulated widely. A cameo was produced by Josiah Wedgwood, which put this plaintive question on the lips of a slave: "Am I not a man and a brother?" A boycott was organized against slave-grown sugar. A total of 519 petitions signed by thousands of Brits was presented in the House of Commons. Thousands of pamphlets were produced and distributed. So this is that diagram that I mentioned before that was distributed. This is a ship, and these that look like sardines are human beings. And that's how they were transported. This is what it must have looked like. Those are feet. And this is a close-up of that. And that's how they existed for the duration of the Middle Passage, lying in their own filth and excrement. And so you have that distributed. This is a scene from the movie. That kind of thing was not uncommon. This was not uncommon. drawing of a slave who, is he sick? Is he troublesome? Being tossed overboard, others here, and human beings being treated like animals. Well, these kinds of things were distributed so that people who thought only about profit and self-interest began to realize what this meant for other human beings. And this is what Wedgwood produced, this little cameo. Am I not a man? And am I not a brother? John Pollock, whose biography is excellent, makes the telling observation that Wilberforce was proof that a man may change his times, though we cannot do it alone. And he didn't do it alone. Henry Thornton, Granville Sharp, John Venn, Hannah Moore, James Stephen, Thomas Clarkson, Zachary Macaulay, these were gifted and godly co-laborers in the cause of fighting against the slave trade. And Wilberforce, gracious, diplomatic, deeply spiritual leadership, but he harnessed these gifted people, and under his leadership, they blended into a formidable force for the good of their generation. One writer says, no prime minister had such a cabinet as Wilberforce could summon to his assistance. Another says, it was a unique phenomenon, this brotherhood of Christian politicians. Don't you absolutely long for that kind of thing in our day, in our country? Imagine a brotherhood of Christian politicians doing great work in our country. Well, they had that in their day. But the writer continues, there has never been anything like it since in British public life. Final push in the campaign comes in January 2nd, 1807, when a bill was read in the House of Commons calling for the abolition of the slave trade. The bill is passed with a tremendous majority, 283-16, and applause rains down on Wilberforce, who sits with his head bowed, tears streaming down his face. And he turns to his friend Henry Thornton, his co-laborer, and he says, well, Henry, what shall we abolish now? And Thornton, who was, I suppose, challenged in the area of humor, says, the lottery, I think. The last 18 years of Wilberforce's life would be a sustained effort now to bring an end to slavery itself. And tracts would be distributed. Wilberforce would write. A man named Thomas Foxwell Buxton would be brought in. You see, Wilberforce by this time is aging. His energy levels are down, and so they need someone else to spearhead the movement. And Buxton was the man. Finally, 3 months before he died, an ailing Wilberforce was persuaded to present a last petition for the abolition of slavery before the House of Commons. And this is what he says. He says, I never thought to appear in public again, but it shall never be said that William Wilberforce is silent while the slaves require his help. On July 29th, 1833, just 3 days after the bill for the total abolition of slavery is passed, Wilberforce dies. Let me say something now about his character. He is a Christian man. You don't understand him if you don't understand that. Let me show you some of the virtues that he manifested as a Christian man. The fruit of the Spirit was abundantly evident. He was a humble man. He could take criticism. His friends used to criticize him because he was a little disorganized. He would be so busy, he wouldn't write in response to letters that are sent to him. And people would say, well, you need to deal with that. You need to be more organized. And humbly, he would acknowledge that. Not only would he acknowledge criticism and receive it, but he would also be reticent to take credit. There's a rare virtue. He considered himself unworthy of a title. Throughout his life, he realized that he needed to work with other people. He couldn't do it alone. He was humble enough to realize that he had to network. He was a prayerful man. A prayerful politician. The morning hours were particularly precious to him as he considered those morning hours as seasons, I quote, of unusual importance for communing with God. He was a joyful man. People enjoyed being around William Wilberforce. He was described as the most religious man in England, as well as the wittiest. And Hannah Moore said this of him. She was a wonderful, godly woman of letters. And she said that Wilberforce had as much wit as if he had no piety, which I thought was very interesting. He was a man of great faith. He labored faithfully and fervently and left the results with God. It was a faith that was resilient. And after one of the many defeats, he said this: God has given the very small increase there has been thus far and must give all if there be more. A man of faith. And his faith was nurtured by his favorite authors, Philip Doddridge, Richard Baxter, John Owen, John Flavel, John Howe, Jonathan Edwards. He would not have called himself a Calvinist, but these are the guys he reads. He was a man of great endurance. In 1791, John Wesley, from his deathbed, writes to him. And yes, we can mention John Wesley here. Sorry, that's from the film A Petition. So John Wesley, from his deathbed, writes to Wilberforce, and this is what he says: unless God has raised you up for this very thing, you will be worn out by the opposition of men and devils. But if God before you, who can be against you? Are all of them together stronger than God? Oh, be not weary of well-doing. Go on in the name of God and in the power of his might till even American slavery, the vilest that ever saw the sun, shall vanish away before it. And so Wilberforce is encouraged by this man who urges him to press on and to endure. And he would have to endure because opposition would come fast and furious. He would be slandered. I mean, today he's celebrated in Christian circles, but he's slandered in his day. He's slandered in the press. And this is what he writes. He says, if all that was published about me was true, nothing but a special providence can have prevented my being hanged 30 years ago. At one point, they accuse him of beating his wife at the time he was single. Lord Nelson, whom we revere and celebrate, called Wilberforce a hypocrite. And others accused him of exciting insurrection in the West Indies. An insurrection had occurred, and obviously it was his fault. And he pressed on, and he pressed on, and he persevered, and he endured. So what I'm saying is, this is a Christian man. And throughout his life, throughout his service for God and country, he manifested these kinds of Christian virtues, consistent Christianity. But secondly, he was a weak vessel. In addition to persecution, he had to deal with tremendous physical difficulties. And among other things, because of curvature of the spine, he had to wear a steel frame for support for the last 18 years of his life. His shoulder began to slope, and you can see it in some paintings, and his head would fall forward and wouldn't be raised without a particular effort, and this steel girdle was very, very difficult and painful. But regarding this steel frame that helped him to continue to function and move, he says this: how gracious is God in giving us such mitigations and helps in our infirmities. I mean, tremendous difficulties, not the least of which was problems with his eyesight. I don't know what your weaknesses are, but I suspect that they were, whatever weaknesses you have, pale in comparison to what he had to suffer. But God used him mightily. God can use you. He was a weak vessel. He was then also a zealous evangelist. He was a man of tremendous evangelistic zeal. After he died, they found a sheet of paper in his affairs, and at the top of the paper was called Friends, was written Friends Paper, and it was a list of his friends, about 30 of them, and besides each name, with thoughts about how he might, when he converses with them, be able to press the gospel home to them. This is not just a man involved in the reformation of manners and the slave trade. Here's a man who's concerned to see men and women brought to the saving knowledge of Christ. Not the least of whom, William Pitt, profoundly concerned and is always witnessing to his friend, William Pitts. He also had a list. He had, on a page, he wrote down what he called launchers. These are ideas as to how he might turn any conversation in the direction of something spiritual. How can I launch this conversation in the direction of conversation about Christ? He was a zealous evangelist. And then also, he was a family man. He was a family man. Well, you need to have another picture from the movie, and so here's the actress. It's actor now. They're all actors, I guess, not actresses. So here are drawings of Barbara Spooner, the woman he would marry, and here is the actress who portrays her, and here the couple is together. In an age of marital infidelity, when marital infidelity amongst politicians was frequent and appalling, it's encouraging to read about the Wilberforce home. A whirlwind romance with Barbara Ann Spooner led to a wedding in 1797, and the marriage, we're told, was pleasant and happy. Hannah Moore, who, as I said, is a close friend of his, said that she had never seen an honest gentleman more desperately in love. Not everybody was happy with Barbara, and they loved Wilberforce, but they were not overly thrilled with Barbara. Other people noted that, these are descriptions of her from some of his friends. She was slow, whiny, fussy, and altogether a poor housekeeper. But it turned out great. They had a happy home, and they loved each other, and she was very protective of him, which was important, because he's the kind of man who would kill himself with his work. He was also an exemplary father. At one point, he resigned his Yorkshire seat for a seat in a smaller borough so that he might spend more time with his growing family. That's a good example to fathers in our day, isn't it? Above all, he was concerned about the souls of his children. He writes to one of his sons, Samuel, and he says, "I would be willing to walk barefoot from this place to Sandgate to see clear proof of the great change having begun in my dear Samuel at the end of the journey." Nonetheless, even though he recognized that the spiritual interests of his children were his primary object, his first concern, he also loved to play with them. And he closes a letter. He writes to Hannah Moore, and he closes one of his letters to her by saying this: "I am irresistibly summoned to a game of marbles." You mustn't imagine, though, that everything was peachy in his family and that everything was idyllic. It wasn't. One of his sons, William Jr., just lurched from one financial disaster to another, and William Sr. probably threw good money after bad, trying to help his son. And then, irony of ironies, one of his daughters fell in love with a debt-ridden West Indian slave owner. Thankfully, the affair came to nothing, but they experienced the same kinds of family issues and troubles that we do. So, he was a family man. There's a sketch of his character. Now, some lessons to close. Number one, surely the life of Wilberforce should stir the souls of Christian politicians and stir them to attempt great things, to remain faithful to God in the often sordid world of politics. God is still in our day able to use weak vessels to accomplish great things. So, where are the men of faith and the women of faith who will labor in the realm of politics for the good of the church and for the good of our generation? And we should pray that God would raise up such folk for the good of our country and the glory of our God. Secondly, let us seek to encourage those and support those Christians who are involved in politics. It was a vital ministry of John Newton, encouraging him back into politics, urging him to move forward, instructing him that God may well have raised him up for a great purpose in that realm. And what an encouraging thing it must have been to receive from John Wesley the letter that he did. Well, you and I want to encourage Christians who are involved in politics about the legitimacy of involvement in politics, the necessity of maintaining integrity when they're involved in politics, the need to remain faithful to biblical principles as they engage in their life's calling. And not only do we want to encourage such people, but the weight of the biblical injunction to pray for our leaders must weigh heavily upon us. Too often, it's more invectives that are found in our lips than intercessions. And connected with this, I want to encourage you to do all you can to support, as individuals and as churches, do all you can to support something called Christian Embassy. And they're an excellent agency who are involved in really being witnesses to politicians. They're based in Ottawa, in our nation's capital, and there they're trying to shine the light of Jesus Christ and shine that light on the lives of those who are leaders of our country. God bless them. We want to do all we can to support them. Thirdly, the slavery issue of our day must be vigorously addressed. And I'm not talking now about literal slavery, although that still happens in our day. I'm talking about something else. The grotesque violence of slavery is matched by the vile and wholesale slaughter of the unborn in our day. And if Wilberforce could not be silent as long as the slaves needed his help, we cannot be silent while unborn children are being slaughtered in our day. Shame on Christians who waffle on this matter and who wag their tongues about other things and won't lift a finger to save those who are being slaughtered. Come on. It says next. Oh, there it is. Thanks, Marino. Wilberforce said, "You may choose to look the other way, but you can never say again that you didn't know." 100,000 children killed in the womb every year in our country. 100,000 children killed in the womb every year in our country. 100,000 killed every year in our country. Now you may choose to look the other way, but you can never say again that you didn't know. We're almost done. Fourthly, we ought to be thankful for the well-documented history of Christian philanthropy. The work of the Christian church has richly benefited society and countries around the world. We need to be quick to set the record straight when uninformed people talk about the withering impact of hypocritical Christians upon the world. Know that Christians have, in every generation, been light and salt in this poor world. And lastly, let Christian leaders follow in the footsteps of this man. Let all of us, including our leaders, humbly and enthusiastically work together, esteeming the gifts of others, rejecting a lone ranger mentality. Let us press on in the face of opposition and persecution, disappointment, and even occasionally disaster. Let us seek glory for God and not for men. Let us be inflamed with a love for God and for His people and for our generation. And let us throw ourselves into our life's work with passion and with faith. It is hoped and believed that the Lord has raised us, raised you, for the good of His church and the good of our nation. I'll close with this. Here are some books. I recommend Garth Lean's book, Christian Politician. If you want something a little easier to introduce you to Wilberforce, this is a good one. This is excellent too, Belmont's book. This is a book by, I think, a retired now politician in England named William Hague, and he's not a believer. And you can understand this when he writes. He doesn't understand Wilberforce. He loves them and he reveres them and he writes up, 400 pages. But he doesn't get his conversion. He doesn't understand it. He doesn't get what really drove the man. And that's a little sad. And then this is Wilberforce's book here. It's really worth a read, Real Christianity. This is Metaxas' book, and that's good as well. On a smaller scale is John Piper's one. This is one of the biographical sketches that he presents over the years at his conference, and that's really good. And my personal favorite is John Pollock and his book on Wilberforce, full of wonderful information. And I close with this eventually. It's going to come. There it is. I close with this. These are the words of Wilberforce himself. A private faith that does not act in the face of oppression is no faith at all. Let us prove the genuineness of our faith by living for the glory of our God and for the good of our generation.